You're listening to the Mushroom Revival Podcast.
Over 1.25 million fungal specimens share a space known as the Fungarium at the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew. It is the largest collection of dried fungi in the world, containing specimens dating as far back as the 1700s. It's comparable to a global seed bank, but for fungal tissue. And today, we welcome two of the mycologists on the team who run the show and help make this epic collection possible.
I'm Tuula Niskanen. I'm a researcher and I work in Royal Botanic Gardens Kew in London. And I study fungal diversity. And basically, I'm interested in knowing which fungi occur in the world and where they occur in the world, and I also describe new species to science. And why I am interested in fungi is that without fungi, we would not really exist.
My name is Lee Davis, and I am one of the curators here at Kew's Fungarium. My job is a bit like a librarian, I guess. So I make sure that the collections are available for researchers to use, everything from looking at biochemistry up to the genetics of fungi. The Fungarium as a whole is a huge and important resource for fungal science because of the taxonomic range and the historical breadth of the collections that we have.
It's basically a collective memory of biodiversity that has been collected in there.
So today on the show, we are getting archival. When, where, why, and how are fungi from all over the world collected, studied, and preserved?
There are, of course, other fungaria in the world, but it's a very historical collection and has many very valuable parts in it. And for example, it includes 50,000 type specimens of fungi.
So type specimens, these are specimens that essentially define a species. They are the original materials used to link a fungus and the name it was given by taxonomists. Kew has a particularly impressive collection of these type specimens, and with current DNA technologies, nearly all of the dried fungi can be sequenced to further genetics research.
And for those who don't know, what's the importance of a fungarium? Is there a reason why you need the dry specimens and not just pictures? I mean, what are the different uses of a fungarium?
A good question. So yes, we want to have the specimens because if you would have a photograph, and later on it would be revealed that there are several species that look alike, you wouldn't be able to tell from the photo which species that is. So you need something physical. And also the physical specimens, they also store the genomes of fungi. So with the current methods, we are able to read quite a lot of the genetic code of species, even from the very old fungarium specimens.
Are there any instances where you have a specimen that you can't derive any genetic information, and what do you do in that instance?
Yes, there are cases when we are not able to extract any DNA or it has been chopped in so small species that it's not useful anymore. So then we can't have the genetic information, but still we have the morphological information. So at least we have the dried mushroom, or if it's a small cup fungus, for example, we have that one. So it's still enough for morphological studies to use that, for example, to how they differ from other species that have been found. And there are also other uses. So it's also a historical memory. So if certain species are collected at a certain time of the history, let's say during the Chernobyl accident, or species collected before that or after that, and there was a lot of radiation. Some of that radiation was also, it went to the fungi, the mushrooms. So you can see kind of the effect of the Chernobyl from these dried fungi that have been collected before the accident and after the accident. So this is, for example, another type of use for fungi, or there might be cases when you need a certain substance from fungi, whether it will be something related that they are toxic or they have some other characteristics. So you can have mushroom specimens and you can try to extract these substances from the dried fungi.
So I'm curious, when you allow researchers to come into the fungarium, who are these people? Are they pharmacologists looking for new species of fungi to investigate their chemical compounds, or curious mycologists, ecologists? Who tends to come through your doors and why?
Mostly they are other taxonomists, so people who are interested in studying which fungi occur in the world and how they are related to one another. So that's the main bulk of visitors. But of course, there are some who are, as you mentioned, interested in their ecology or their chemistry. So all kinds of visitors, and also artists want to come there just to see like what kind of fungi there are, and historians to see kind of the history. And of course, Fungarium is also linked to the arts library and archives that we have in Kew, which stores a lot of the literature, the paintings, and that type of information. So it's used by many different types of people, and of course students as well.
Anyone who is interested can visit the Fungarium, and upon request, they will prepare a sample of a given specimen to support researchers. So under what circumstances are they pulled from the archives? Who's asking for them and why?
Usually we're really very open to the idea of people using the collections, especially when it comes to what gets termed destructive sampling. So taking pieces of a specimen, grinding it up and, you know, getting the DNA out of it, or looking at the biochemistry of it. So normally if a researcher contacts us and said, oh, I'd like to borrow this specimen for DNA work, especially if it hasn't been looked at before for those purposes, we will almost always say yes, because the real value in the collection is the data that we get associated with that specimen. And sometimes getting that data means destroying a part of a specimen. Luckily, if someone's doing genomics work, they might take out a piece of the gills, you know, a few millimeters in square, for instance. So it's not always the whole thing that gets destroyed. It's a small piece. And as long as we get that data back, that's adding value to the specimen, if you like.
The majority of specimens are preserved by simply drying them. No special tricks. Although ideally, the specimens are collected and dried as soon as possible. You can do this with a standard food dehydrator set no higher than 40 degrees Celsius or 104 Fahrenheit to preserve the DNA. Once they've been completely dried, they go into envelopes with their respective information and are filed away next to their sister taxa.
We do have a relatively small collection that's preserved in spirit, which I think is I think there's a little bit of formaldehyde and ethanol in it. For fungi that are quite interesting three-dimensionally, like some of the stinkhorns, for instance. But I think that's, you know, a few thousand specimens are stored like that. The everything else, you know, 1.25 million, they're dried. That's all we do. It seems that drying is all that's completely necessary. As long as you then store them in an environment which is kept stable and cool, and the humidity needs to be kept sort of 50%. And that sort of is all that's required. I mean, we have that's and as far as we can tell, that is all that you need to do. And that will keep them usable for potentially centuries. We've got stuff here that's well over 100 years old that was dried, probably more poorly dried than things would be now, but we can still get useful DNA out of it, for instance. We had someone doing some research and looking at genome sequencing for British fungi, and there seemed to be a strong correlation between usable DNA collected in the past from fungi in the past, say, 20 years. There's a strong correlation between how quickly and efficiently it was dried out by the person who collected it and how well we were able to get DNA out of it. So I think it seems, you know, you get a good person who dries it quickly, not too hot, and then you keep it in good conditions, and it will, it seems to be centuries is what we're looking at.
For fungi, we have two very big rooms full of these cupboards where you can store specimens. And also they are monitoring, for example, pests so that nothing gets wild there and starts to eat the fungi. Mostly in the fungarium, you will find mushroom-forming fungi, so something you can see with your bare eye. However, we also have pathogenic fungi, so for example, rusts and smuts that are growing on the leaves or on the flowers. So part of our collections are also dried plants, so plants with these fungi. So you can find see these arcs, paper arcs, where you can see the pressed plant, and on top of those plant leaves, for example, you have a fungus. In Kew, we don't have those so much, but another option is also to store a culture. So if you have a very teeny tiny fungus, well, teeny tiny in a sense that it forms a teeny tiny mushroom, and it's hard to preserve like that, you can culture it, and then you can store the mycelium in minus 80, and then that's the way to store the fungus.
And I'm guessing these are organized in a special way, and is it alphabetical? Are you, you know, organizing it by Basidiomycota, Ascomycota, and then, you know, you have a Cortinaria section over here, you have a Cordyceps section over here, you know, how is this organized?
Usually, as you mentioned, it's organized by taxonomical order. So Cortinaris is in one place, Russula is in one place. There is also a bit of a geographical organization. So one room is dedicated to fungi collected from the UK, and then the other room is for the fungi collected from other parts of the world. And within these two rooms, then, inside those, they are in taxonomical order. However, this is now tricky because not all of the collections are digitized yet, because it's a huge work to put all, to capture all the data and put it available online. So only half of the specimens are currently digitized and half of them are not. About 600,000 specimens are still not digitized. And when the arrangement is like this, if you would ask me, how many specimens do we have from Congo, or how many specimens do we have, for example, from a South American country like Bolivia, I wouldn't be able to answer you at the moment, because that kind of country information is not something you can search by just going to the cupboards, but you would need to capture first the label data, have it online, and then be able to search for it. And this is, of course, a problem, and it has been recognized. And one of the top priorities in Kew is to basically get all of the data online searchable so that the collections would be the most useful for everyone.
That is such a massive feat with so many different, you know, species and collections. And I was reading that you have collected fungi from over 240 countries on all seven continents. I was looking it up because I was wondering how many countries there were, and according to ISO country code standard, there are 249 countries in the world. 194 of them are independent. So it seems you're missing about 9 countries to collect fungi from. Do you have a bucket list of countries that you haven't collected fungi from that you're dying to go to an expedition from, or get people to send fungi from that certain country?
So we don't have that yet. And as I mentioned, since we don't know exactly where all of our collections are from, this is a sophisticated guess at the moment of at least we know from how many countries we have, which are digitized, but there might be some more in those that are not digitized yet. But yes, that would be really awesome to know. It's like, oh, only 5 countries lacking anymore, so let's go hunting. So,
right.
Yes, right. Of course. There's,
yeah, that would be really fun.
Yes, but of course there is also a division between different fungaria in the world. So usually if you have a fungarium in the country, you want to store the specimens from your own country, the species that are collected from your own country. So that's kind of usually the main thing people are focused on having materials. And then you want to have from different parts of the world where the researchers from your institute are working. So usually it's kind of a combination of of course, national things, and then what we are interested in internationally. But since Q has such a large network and people have been working in many different parts of the world, plus people have been sending materials from different parts of the world to Q, so yes, that's a very amazing and impressive collection of fungi from all around the world. And since not all of them are studied yet, there are also many new species to science, even new genera and new families to science that are stored there, and they are just waiting for someone to discover them.
So almost 2,000 species, actually 1,886 species of fungi were scientifically named for the first time in 2019. I don't have any stats for 2020. Does this number keep going up? Is this really high for this year? I'm just curious statistically on how many new fungi we're finding each year.
So this figure comes from the State of the World's Plant and Fungi Report. And this is a very important report. In 2018, we did the first one concentrated only on fungi, and it was the first alike, and it was done led by Q, but done in cooperation with researchers worldwide. And that report got a lot of attention. For example, in the UK, it was more than 150 articles were written about it in the papers, and it was estimated that maybe 70% of the UK adults got some information about this report. So this this kind of a the report, it aims to give a summary information of what is our current state of knowledge on fungal diversity, about the importance of fungi in the nature, what are the uses of fungi, what are the threats of fungi, and what kind of actions we are taking to maintain the fungal diversity and its sustainable use. So one part of this report was this new species that I was writing together with my colleagues. And yes, 2,000 of species per year, approximately, or a bit more, 2,500 are described yearly. And that has been quite stable for the last 5 years. But before that, it was less. And the main reason is the invention of molecular methods. So in fungi, they are quite hard to study. Most of their time, they live under the ground as hyphae, and just in certain times they form these mushrooms, or they don't form them at all. And characters that we can use to differentiate between different species are few, and there hasn't been that many researchers. Also, the number of fungi is really big, so it's 7 times more than the flowering plants. And most of the fungi are still unknown. 90% of the species are still undescribed. So taking all of these things together, the fungal species are poorly known. And when the molecular methods were invented, they allowed us far better to see how fungi should be classified. So we started to recognize the true diversity of fungi, and also then the number of species that we described per year started to rise. Currently, yes, we are doing this 2,000-2,500 per year, which sounds quite a lot, like, oh, wow, so many new species are found per year. But with the current speed, it will take us 1,000 years before we have described all the remaining ones. And yes, there are fungi that are important for us in industry. So 60% of the enzymes that they use in industry come from fungi. And there are also medicines that come from fungi, penicillin that is used to treat bacterial infections. And also there are medicines for the multiple sclerosis and to treat high cholesterol. So there are many different kind of things we can get from fungi. And since they like to break down things, what is really hot and pop, and what has been kind of been highlighted lately, is that fungi can also break down plastic. So this can So basically, fungi, as we know more about them, they can probably, well, they already have, and they will change our lives, but they may even save our lives. And by giving them a name, we basically recognize them, and because without a name, they will go unnoticed, although they have these very, very important functions in the nature and also benefits for us humans.
And do you do any of that research at the Fungarium? Do you do chemical analysis to figure out any functional compounds, or, you know, do analysis of the enzymes for microremediation purposes or anything like that? Textile analysis, or do you send these to third-party companies that can do that sort of analysis on all these new species?
We don't do that much in Q. So most of our work is focused on the classification of fungi. So basically producing the framework and tools for the others to then go further with fungi. So we produce the classification. We recognize how they are related to one another, but then also we study their function in nature and to some extent their use as well. But the main function, kind of the main purpose of Q, is to study the biodiversity and produce the kind of the baseline knowledge of the importance of fungi.
The shroom boom is here. Fungal innovation in tech, medicine, fashion, therapy, and engineering are at an all-time high. And compared to the tens of thousands of species at the Fungarium, we estimate that a few hundred at best are currently showing up in research and development. And the fungi that are being investigated have already proved their profound potentials for a better future. And if we're barely using 1% of what we do know is out there, we are looking at a colossal selection of fungal partners. The Fungarium is here for us, and here for you. With over 1 million specimens and approximately 70,000 species, mycocurious minds like you have this truly epic resource. What are some extra special specimens at Kew, you ask? Well, while we agree that they are all important, we asked Lee, one of the curators at Kew, to describe specimens that are particularly memorable or hold some kind of superlative record.
The smallest specimen of the Fungarium we have quite a lot of small specimens. There's a whole group of fungi that are unicellular, so a single cell. So for instance, things called chytrids, which are ecologically important, that people might, in a way that people are aware of, because these are pathogenic on amphibians. So there's been a lot of press over the past decade or two about chytrid fungi killing off amphibians. And we have a collection of chytrid fungi. So those are a few tens of microns across, if you like. These are microscopic slides that we have with minuscule little microscopic fungi on them. The largest specimen I have is a bracket fungus. So these are wood-eating specialists. And they form these sort of bracket or plate-like fruiting bodies that come out of the sides of trees or rotting logs. The biggest one I have is about half a circle's worth, and it's about 2.5 feet across. I think it's an Inonotus that's about 2.5 feet across.
So are there any specimens that you particularly find memorable? Like if you were giving a tour and you wanted someone to be over the moon about what you have going on in the Fungarium, what would you show them?
Oof. So there's one specimen I always get out if I've got tours and what have you going on. It's a fungus that's called Ophiocordyceps tayloriae. So it's a parasite. It's a parasite of caterpillars. The specimen we've got, this particular one, it's about 150 years old, and it comes from Australia. And it's a caterpillar that's all dried up. The caterpillar itself is bigger than, say, your middle finger. It's a good 3 or 4 inches long. It's a big fat caterpillar, but it's been parasitized by this fungus, and the fruiting body growing out of the caterpillar itself is about 8-9 inches long and is quite chunky looking mushroom, produced this really big substantial mushroom type thing. It's really gross. People get really freaked out and quite horrified of it. It's a great one to use. It's enormous. I mean, we have a lot of entomopathogenic fungi, but they're all very small. We've got quite a lot of gunnii here as well, but they're maybe an inch or two long. They're sort of slimmer than a pencil. But this Paler eye I've got is just colossal. It's really chunky and grotesque.
If you'd like to see photos of this monster cordyceps, be sure to check the show notes. It's delightfully morbid.
We have this. Oh, there's one we call it squid fungus that is usually pretty nifty. So there's a whole group of fungi that are what we call the stinkhorns. They're named the Phalaceae, and they produce really unusual mushrooms. They've kind of gone beyond the normal mushroom-shaped type fruiting body, and they produce things. You know, they look the stinkhorns. They look like penises. They look like geodesic spheres. This one particular one is squid fungus. It looks like an octopus or a squid emerging out the ground. And they all stink. They all produce this gunge called gleba that smells of rotting meat and poo. And they use insects to disperse their spores rather than the normal sort of wind and air dispersal mechanisms of almost all other fungi. And it looks gross and it's a great thing to whip out and show people.
And not only does the Kew Gardens have the most impressive collection of specimens, but I read that your mycological library is one of the most extensive of taxonomic literature on fungi in the world. You've got books, periodicals, offprints, and so many other things. Can you talk about this collection of literature? Are you continuing to look for more things to add? Are you personally writing anything, or is the Kew writing any books to kind of wrap it all up? I mean, what work is being done on the literary side of this?
We still keep collecting literature, both journals and then books. They can be books for public or more for identification. But yes, it's still an important part of Kew's library work to collect literature. Especially when it comes to the books, they are usually not available online. So having them physically, it's real an asset. And I have to admit that before I came to Kew, I had difficulties to obtain literature, or to, especially in taxonomy, where you can have like 200 years old books that you would need to access, and there are only a couple of copies of them existing in the world. So when I came to Kew, I was really, really like, wow, this is like a treasure for me, because everything is just like there, available for you. All the history, the memory, and all the information. So yes, it's really important still to have a place where you can really physically have all knowledge and literature gathered in one place.
And I was just chatting with Juliana Ferci, who is an incredible woman, and she's one of my dear friends, and she told me that she knows you and has traveled to Chile with you many times. And actually, you guys both described a new Cortinaria species together. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. And it was a really, really beautiful one because it's green. Most of the Cortinaria species are brown, plus minus brown, so they are not that fancy looking ones, but this was green. So Juliana was like, Tula, I have a species here and it's green, and she was taking so many photographs of that, and she was like, oh, this must be something very, very exciting. And it took a couple of years to study the taxonomy, but yes, it turned out to be a new species to science, and we decided to name it Cortinarius chlorosplendidus. So chloro referring to green, and splendidus like a splendid appearance it had. So it's not a very big one. So it's about the height of my fingers, and the cap is maybe 3-4 centimeters wide. But the color, the green color, that was really striking and exotic.
Juliana called you the queen of Cortinarius, and you know, she wanted me to ask you about the old classification of Cortinarius based on how viscid the cap, stipe, or both was. It seems like there was an old way to classify Cortinarius that's pretty interesting.
Yes. Always when you try to classify things, you try to select characteristics that would be easy to use. And in Cortinarius, the sliminess of the cap and how the mushroom forms, does it first open the cap and then the stipe elongates, or does it first elongate the stipe and then the cap opens? These type of characteristics were used to put Cortinarius in different genera or subgenera. And after we started to use molecular methods, we realized that not all of these classifications were natural, so they were not really reflecting the relatedness of the species in reality. And now we are revising the classification of Cortinarius. However, to some extent, these still hold. So of course, the more closely related the species are, the more similar they are. So some of the characters we had selected before the molecular era to be used for the classification still hold, but some of them we need to revise and look for other characters that might better reflect the natural classification of this fungi. But I think the sliminess is one thing that is kind of, people probably like it because it's something you can easily observe. Is cap slimy or not? Some of the Cortinarius species are so slippery slimy that they are even almost hard to pick up. So that's one good thing. And then the color. So like obvious things, because there are species that are red, yellowish, and these greenish colors. So they were more like classified as the one group. And then there were more of these which are dull colored ones. So yes, in the beginning we tended to use things that were easy to observe and easy to use for classification. And yeah, maybe I can tell one thing more what we use in Cortinarius. Some of the species in Cortinarius, they are very acrid or kind of don't taste really nice. And you can already by licking the cap, you can feel this acridness. And one of the core groups of Cortinarius is called vibratiles. So I used to say to the people that you can recognize it so that you lick the cap and then it makes you vibrate. And that's the
I love how many different ways there are to, you know, subtly ID a mushroom, from, you know, the sliminess to the taste to even, you know, the smell. And this has me thinking, if you have this many dried specimens in the fungarium, when you walk in, do you get hit by this, you know, is it just this waft of dried mushroom smell? I mean, is it really earthy in there, or can you smell it at all if they're all, are they, you know, sealed in drawers?
You don't really smell that because they have been packed. So since they are in these envelopes, and usually within the envelopes there are in these small bags, and then these are again in a cupboard, in the boxes and then in the cupboards, so you can't really smell that much when you go into the fungarium. However, in some occasions when you open the box and then you take the specimens out, some fungi still have the smell left. But when you go into the fungarium, no, it's not earthy or anything. It's just
right.
more like a normal room. But yes, I wanted to add one thing to the previous question.
Yep. So,
of course, tasting fungi. Don't ever taste a fungus unless you know which species that is. So, for example, in Cortinarius, there is one lineage where there are deadly poisonous species. So never, ever lick, taste, or kind of bite a fungus unless you know what it is.
Solid advice. Do you have a favorite Cortinarius species?
This is a tough question. I'm thinking, like, which Cortinarius would make me the most happy if I would find it? Yeah, so there are different ways of approaching this. One way would be this, like, what would I most likely want to see? There is, for example, this kind of this cortinarius called cortinarius inexpectatus. And I have never seen it in nature. It's said that it's usually growing in spring or early summer. And when I started to study cortinarius over 20 years ago, I had a cortinarius flora or this kind of an identification book, and this species was in there. So, of course, you always think that if a species is in a book, it's something you can find. So this species is still in my to-be-found list. So most of the other ones, if not all, I have already found myself. But this cortinarius inexpectatus, that's still hiding from me. So that would be really nice to see.
And I'm sure you have such an interesting perspective on the whole mycology world. I know cortinarius is your bread and butter, but, you know, working at the Kew Gardens and seeing the fungarium and all these different species in one place, it really gives you a 10,000 feet perspective, so to speak, on all fungi in the world. So I'm curious, what would you like to see in the mycological world? What sort of research, what sort of advancements, besides finding that one cortinarius, you know, what would you like to see done or found, discovered, etc.?
I will choose the one that is closest to me. So what I would personally want to achieve is a pipeline where I could easily describe a fungal species, and simultaneously an identification database would be created that then would be possible to use by anyone who wants to re-identify that species. I think the modern technology already would allow us to do that, and that if that could be achieved, and I would be able to deliver my knowledge with just one push of a button to anyone in the world, that's my dream, because that would be super cool, because there are so many fungi to be found and things that we would need to know about them. So the more easily I would be able to deliver my knowledge to anyone else, the better it would be to basically stop the biodiversity loss and then to help people to study the many, many important things the fungi do in the nature and how important they are to us.
I think the work that you guys are doing is unbelievable. I'm super inspired and awed at the work that everyone involved at Kew Garden is doing. So thank you.
We also want to tell our listeners about the State of the World report that you put out. The trend seems to be every 2 years, Kew Gardens releases a report on contemporary applications and understanding of fungi. And this was one of the more satisfying and comprehensive reads that I've come across on this topic. So thank you. Thank you to Kew and the 97 other institutions that collaborate on it. I will have links in the show notes for those of you who are interested and want to check it out. And Tula, if there is anything else that you want to share with us about your work or how we can support Kew, we welcome that fully.
Maybe I would say to anyone who is listening to this, I hope you will be excited about the wonderful world of fungi. And if you want to get more involved, look the local mushroom clubs. So, for example, in North America, the North American Mycological Association, or in the UK, the British Mycological Association, and then under those, the local clubs. Get involved, get together with other people who are interested in fungi, start to learn more about them, and then you might be part of the change and maybe help the future research by being a citizen scientist or a field mycologist. Maybe, as we talked just a while ago, mapping fungi that are red listed mapping fungi for conservation, for ecology, for our increasing our understanding of fungal world.
Thanks to Lee and Tula and the whole team at the Fungarium for building a super badass resource. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in and shrooming in and making this coverage possible.
You can support the show and keep content like this coming by visiting our website, mushroomrevival.com, and purchasing any of our products. And if you are a listener, which you are by listening right now, you get a special discount for 10% off. Just enter MR Podcast at checkout. That's all capital letters, MR Podcast at checkout. Please keep spreading the spores. Tell all your friends, your family, your coworkers, everybody about mushrooms, the show, and how they can form a sacred relationship with fungi. And as always, much love, and may the spores be with you.